would come up and speak briefly about John Nall, who was with the planning department since his graduation from Cal Poly. So he's been with the department for approximately 30 years, as has his wife, Karen. And Cammie's going to speak a little bit about John's accomplishments.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to talk about John Nall's service with the county. I could go on and on about John's accomplishments, as he had many in his nearly 30 years with the county, but I'm going to try and keep it short this morning. As you all remember, whenever John spoke to either your board or the Planning Commission, he always introduced himself as your principal environmental specialist. And then he would launch into some explanation or clarification on some technical point of the California Environmental Quality Act. He was an absolute expert in CEQA. His depth of knowledge and commitment to doing the job right was evident in every project he worked on, whether it was a small, simple project or a very large, complicated one like the Guadalupe oil spill cleanup. He was always calm, even in the face of very sticky situations or folks who were upset, and we counted on him all the time to come in and diffuse situations and help figure out solutions. Lots of us were also privileged to call John a friend, and we have backpacking and camping trips and lots of conversations around the campfire. It was very important to have a very big campfire that we will hold very, very dear. The department would like to send our deepest condolences to Karen, Renata, and Natalie, and to let them know that they're in our thoughts and hearts at this time. There is a college fund, trust fund being set up, and anybody interested in making donations can contact Ellen Carroll at 781-5028 for more information. There will be a celebration of John's life on Sunday, September 9th at 11:30 at the Cayucas Vets Hall. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cammie.
1:30. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll announce that again. And as you can imagine, losing John in the department after almost 30 years, and his wife Karen, who is also a planner in the department, it's been very impactful to the department as well as the county as a whole. And our sympathy is not only with the family but also the county planning department. And again, there's a celebration of John's life at the Cayucas Veterans Hall this next Sunday, September 9th at 1:30. And again, if you're interested in contributing to the College Trust Fund, Karen and John had two daughters, Renata, who's a sophomore in college, and Natalie, who attends Atascadero High School. Contact Ellen Carroll in the planning department if you're interested in doing that. So with that, we're going to take a moment of silence in memory of John. Thank you. And with that, we'll move along with our agenda. Thank you for being here this morning, those of you who came over from planning. Madam Clerk, would you read any changes to the agenda, please?
We do have one added item to the agenda. It's an added consent item, submittal of a resolution to approve Amendment Number 3 to the Development Traffic Fee Agreement with the Woodlands Ventures, LLC, dated April 25th, 2006, for accelerated payment of South County Road Improvement Area 1 and 2 fees for the Woodlands Development Project in Napomo, District 4. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted 72 hours prior to the noticing requirement.
That's it.
Thank you. And we do have that one consent item to deal with this morning. I'll open it to the public for any comment on that item. I have no request to speak, so I'll bring it back to the board for action.
Move to approve the consent item.
Second.
Okay, it's moved and seconded that we approve consent. Discussion, seeing none. Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Our upcoming activities that the county will take on, I urge you to please provide a full-on forensic audit on the monies that have been spent on the Los Osos sewer project. This is not only money that came is coming in now from the citizens who have to pay for a sewer that hasn't been started. It is also from many, you've gotten so many different grant fundings, and we don't know where they went. We don't know how they were used. When you look at the list, I mean, you don't even put the $5 million conservation cost that is part of, is mandated by the Coastal Commission on this project. It's not even in the list of expenses to date for this sewer project. So I am asking, before Jerry Seebach leaves and things get more chaotic, that you move forward with a full-on forensic audit of the costs and where the monies have gone on this project. I think it's very important, if not to you to know where it went, for us who are trying to be forced into paying for something we don't even know what we're getting yet. There's a fiduciary responsibility from each of you to take care of the entire county, not just your district. And in that respect, I would hope that you would go forward. And then I have a question about the RAC, which is the Water Resources Advisory Committee. We've been trying to get the dewatering put on their agenda, and Mr. Pava Ogren, the head of the Public Works, keeps having it taken off. Now, I don't know why water issues about Los Osos shouldn't be as important as water issues about Paso, Napomo, Oceano, every other city that's going through level severities that are up to 3 now on most places. I wish Pava Ogren would stay out of controlling what goes before RAC. RAC should be looking at everything that affects everyone in this county. So I hope as you move forward, you consider that Los Osos would like to know what you're doing with our sewer project and where the money went. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Piper Riley, followed by Mike Brown.
Good morning, Chairman Patterson. I am Piper Riley from Los Osos. There's a water board meeting regarding dewatering this Thursday. This part of the project was never really evaluated in the EIR or properly vetted by the RAC. Dewatering and other highly impactful aspects of this project have been brought up by the public since the beginning of this process, but were ignored because addressing them would mean acknowledging that the gravity system is not only economically infeasible, it is detrimental to the environment and will destroy the drinking water supply of the entire community of Los Osos, forcing us all to have to import water from Nacimiento. You've ignored the fact that there is no place to put our water supply once you've drained it, except for on Broderson, a large parcel of pristine land where you do not have a permit to put that quantity of water. There are about 600 homes below this site in a liquefaction zone, which could easily make La Conchita look like a day at the park. The greenhouse, not to mention that this destructive endeavor will create greenhouse gases equivalent to about 3 round-trips to the moon and cost untold millions of dollars. As a former executive member of Slow Surfrider and the Los Osos Sustainability Group, I've read lots of documents, and according to Slow Sea and health reports, the Back Bay bordering Los Osos is consistently some of the cleanest water on the Central Coast. The KITS study attests to this, stating that just a small portion of 1% of all the pollution in the protected marine reserve is due to Los Osos septics. Whereas areas near conventional sewers are the worst polluters, especially the CMC, whose Corollo design is basically what you're forcing upon us. The county mismanaged the water supply of multiple communities, and they are desperate to cover it up. With this economy, it is a perfect storm to flip towns, and Seebach basically attested to that. Supervisor Gibson is completely biased and should not be the representative for the county regarding seismic testing. He has admitted in office hours that he feels the newly discovered fault is basically inconsequential. Let's face it, how can he acknowledge it? If he does, he'll have to acknowledge many of the LOWWP's flaws. Please note that this kind of lack of judgment is putting far more than just those in Los Osos at risk on multiple levels. We need to know what's going on. The town is starting to ask, and they want to know why there hasn't been an economic study, why we don't know where our secure water is coming from. You need to stop this freight train. It's going to crash, and it's going to take everybody down eventually. It is grossly unfair what is going on. You have ignored science, and you need to reevaluate this. There needs to be a third party to look into this for economic and environmental reasons. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Riley. Mike Brown, followed by Julie Tacker.
Mike Brown. In fact, these speakers sincerely were expressing their desire and belief and perhaps expertise that they wanted less expansion of the role of this government, particularly the intrusion of a new set of inspectors into their home life in their home. Now, the fact of the matter is that the role of government, that is, the functions of government, are a legitimate academic subject, a major subject over the past 2,000 years of history. In fact, Professor Leslie Lipson, one of the giants of political science at Berkeley, in his great book, The Great Issues of Politics, lists it as one of the five major subjects of political science and history. And it is not to be an ideologue or a demagogue for citizens to come and express their belief here that we should have a more limited sphere of action of the government. And we think that to chastise the sincere people who are expressing that very valued and long-term view, whether you agree with it or not, is again an example of the practice here of chilling public comment.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Julie Tacker, followed by Gwen Taylor.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker from Los Osos, and I have some concerns regarding the Los Osos wastewater project that I thought I'd bring forward today. First being the purchase of the Andre site. It was to have been on your agenda today, according to the public notice that we last saw in the newspaper. A $725,000 purchase. I was able to look back at some Planning Commission agendas and staff reports, and it appears that you want to put an ag easement on that land. And in some comments that Mr. Gibson said, perhaps sell off portions that the wastewater project doesn't use. I would find that growth-inducing and inappropriate. I'm mostly concerned about the use of that land, and that I'd like some confirmation that you will not use it for irrigation. That land has not been farmed in decades and doesn't use water today, so to water it with wastewater doesn't take it off the basin, doesn't take its straw out of the basin, because it's not using water today. So I don't think it's appropriate to try to lose water there. Another concern I have is signed ag contracts with other farmers and farm uses. We haven't seen those. I'd like to know who is going to take the wastewater and what their seawater intrusion mitigation benefit is. And anybody close to getting a contract with the cemetery? The cemetery does use water. And we'd like to see them use wastewater instead. A little concerned about the head fake start of construction that we experienced at the June 19th town hall meeting. construction really has not begun, gentlemen. The Tri-W site has been regraded. Some drainage improvements have been done sparsely around the town. But what I witnessed is contractors taking their lunch on private property, sitting on private property retaining walls, walking through private property flower beds. This was just one project. The whole town is going to experience impacts from the project, and the contractors need to have lunch somewhere else. The Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting is Thursday, and I'd love to see all of you there. I am concerned about the representation that will be there for Los Osos, and the dewatering that was not analyzed in the EIR. We'll have to hear about it there.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Gwen Taylor, followed by George Taylor.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor. I'm a resident of Los Osos. But this comment is referenced to every one of you sitting on that dais. The county is facing water problems, not only in rural areas, but other areas throughout our county. Rural area residents are facing the same major problems with water supply as Los Osos. The potential of losing their homes due to their inability to patient plan is not the answer. It creates many problems that the public have addressed, and these problems yet the Public Works does not address them in their reports to the Coastal Commission and to the Regional Water Quality Control Board. The lack of action is unacceptable to those that are in the assessment district and are paying the cost. Is Supervisor Gibson paying more attention to the seismic tests than to the concerns of the people of Los Osos who are in his district? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. George Taylor, followed by Claudia Layton.
Good morning, Board. I'm here to present a tribute to Bo Cooper. Bo Cooper is someone I looked up to. I met him several years ago and was awestruck by the way he kept a measure of optimistic tone while chaos and confusion circulated around him. He never let Los Osos sewer politics get in the way of his glowing, peaceful aura. He never stopped fighting, but he fought in a way that was admired by people on all sides of the debate. He never raised his voice, never looked at anyone with contempt, never allowed prejudice to sully his message of support for the people. Bo Cooper was sometimes tense, terse, and to the point. When he spoke with Greek-inspired stoical conviction and never wavered. He stood up for what he believed in, which is the common good. The common good was also the name of a column he wrote. His words were so pure, so beautiful, so simplicity and love that time can never stain them. In one column he wrote, quote, "I will insist upon having meaningful participation in the political decision process," unquote. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Claudia Layton, followed by Ben Terra.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Supervisor Patterson. I'm Claudia Layton, a Cal Poly graduate, retired elementary school teacher. mother and resident of Morro Bay, and I oppose the Central Coast Seismic Imaging Project. In 2005, the seismically active Hosgri Fault was discovered just 2.5 miles from the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. Then in 2008, the Shoreline Fault was discovered even closer. In 2009, Senator Sam Blakesley sponsored Senate Bill AB 42 with the safety of his constituents in mind, whereby PG&E was mandated to provide seismic testing on these faults. There was huge concern in the community about producing and storing highly radioactive waste in such close proximity to these active faults. However, there was no public indication in 2009 that the seismic testing itself would be as invasive and destructive to our marine ecosystems as it will be. It was not publicly known that unimaginably loud, destructive 250 decibel blasts would explode en masse every 15 seconds, 24 hours a day, for 33 days straight. The blasts have the power to penetrate the sediment of the seafloor and reach several miles into the Earth's crust. We are looking clearly at death to tightly packed swarms of herring and krill, decimation of rockfish, halibut, salmon, sole, cod, and their eggs, destruction of the kelp and eelgrass, in which all species find food, protection, and shelter for their young. These are the organisms that form the basis of our coastal marine food web. Sickness and death here means sickness and death all the way up the chain. We live on a transformed fault nestled between two major tectonic plates, the Pacific and North American plates. They move. That intense pressure created the San Ynez mountain range.
Surfed and dived in the local waters for a long time. I know the waters and the reefs and the coastline better than just about anybody. The California Energy Commission's recommendation to do this seismic imaging, I think they were mistaken because they didn't realize that in doing so, they're going to be violating three major laws that were put into place to protect our local waters. The Marine Life Protection Act started a seven-year process to implement the marine protected areas. I have qualms about the marine protected areas because they took all of our best reefs and closed them, but at the same time, I appreciate the fact that the fish and the marine life is protected there. It's been protected for 4 years. We can't drop one single hook in there. They're going to go in there and kill every single marine organism. Same goes with the rockfish conservation areas. They have been untouched for 9 years. They actually require black cod fishermen to have vessel monitoring systems on their boats so that when they drive through there, they can see that they aren't stopping and fishing. So they're really serious about fishermen not taking one fish in those rockfish conservation areas. And my estimates is that there's tens of thousands of pounds of clean rockfish protein in those RCAs that's all going to be killed for no reason if the seismic testing happens. Furthermore, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, I think we're all familiar with, it's federal legislation against any harm to marine mammals. If this happens, the seismic testing, there's going to be deaths to California sea lions, harbor seals, elephant seals, dolphins, porpoise, sea otters, and multiple whale species. The air gun blasting at 250 decibels is equivalent to the sound intensity of the atomic bomb that was dropped in Hiroshima. Sounds kind of ridiculous, right? Well, it is. I'm a surfer, too. I don't think anybody would be able to surf for the whole time they're doing this because it could cause hearing damage and possible brain damage if you're duck diving or you're underwater when this blasting's happening. The board members have a responsibility to the public interest, and the public interest in this county has clearly been shown that we care a lot about the local waters, and we have done things previously to protect it, and so we need your help to keep this from happening. This testing is not necessary. It's based on a lot of fear because of what happened in Fukushima, but the faults are different around here. And I think we are all aware that there's some underlying motives for this, which is oil exploration. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Tara. Al Barrow, followed by Jeanette Watson.
Thank you. My name is Al Barrow, Coalition for Low-Income Housing, and I did a James Bond change today. I rode in on my bicycle to save a little gas and carbon footprint. And I wanted to say a little word about Bo Cooper. Bo Cooper was a wonderful, wonderful person. I don't think I've ever met a person that had any more class than Bo Cooper. And he left behind a widow, Lacey. And here's an example of what the sewer does for you. She just lost $50,000 household income, and that was the only income the house had. What are they going to do with these facing these fees? When Bo came before us at various groups, he always was concerned about the financial impact to those less fortunate than himself, and he spoke well about that. And I feel like we should consider the fact that the sewer is ridiculously expensive for a small population of people. If you look at Prescott, Arizona, and I encourage the engineering department to look at the Prescott project, which is being built now, it's manages, expands their system 3 million gallons of wastewater treatment, much, much cheaper per gallon than what this engineering department has come up with. More expensive than any. Let's talk about the earthquake out here, earthquake faults. It's obvious. It's a big deal. Earthquakes are all over the place, the faults. Okay, we got a liquefaction zone. You're going to put a gravity sewer in there. And when it goes, that gravity sewer is going to be worthless. Those are the kind of risks that you're putting on us in addition to the horrible expenses. No skin off your nose. You're the county. We're the ratepayers. We have to repay that fee. We have to rebuild that project. That kind of thinking is irresponsible. And that's what you, Mr. Gibson, have been promoting, because his supporters are wealthy people that are making money by their vacant lots rising in value because we're paying for their sewer. They're not paying a penny. And he says they may not pay for 10 years. If you look at the screen here, we have a pie chart. And the pie chart...
Another ruling to harass people and wear them down with the ultimate intention of getting them to live smaller and leaner under the guise of climate change. Therefore, in my opinion, it's not demagoguery to oppose what we see as not fair. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. Laura Mordaunt, followed by Lori Alexiff.
Yes, what I wanted to talk about is the same thing that Jeanette spoke about, and as well Mike Brown. I listened to the other speakers here, and I am impressed with the knowledge that these speakers provide on their topics. I don't know that it actually makes any difference to the board. I don't see any reaction to that when they do. But I am impressed with the citizenry of this county. They're quite intelligent, as you can see. You may not agree. And I think when that lack of agreement is often nastiness. And Mr. Patterson, your person to your left that leans left, that is a real problem. Do not harass those who speak. That is wrong. I don't care what the words were, demagoguery, not adults, fear-mongering. Well, let's look at this chart here that is from the executive summary of the Energy Wise plan. And this has a chart, and it talks about residential as being 15% of the so-called 100% greenhouse gas emissions in our county. And if you would roll that to the second page, please. I'd like to talk about the mathematics here. 15% residential, all right? The board has expressed 80% of the residential is old, so that leaves 12%. Of the problem of greenhouse gases is the old stock. What energy audit fixes could be obtained if all the old homes were fixed according to the mandate which really this is becoming a mandated energy audit. 100%? Do you want those 12% to be 100%, 80%, 70%, 60%? What is real and reasonable? Greenhouse gases that are alleged to be created by the 12%. Okay, there are, like right now, my house, for example, is 50 years old, but it was updated before I purchased it. How many homes are like that that are considered old stock because the date in the books will be a certain number? But over a 12-month period, I would say probably 20% of that stock, if everybody upgraded, everybody took an energy audit and they did everything. So if you take 15%, that's the original residential, 80% of that, 20% of that, you end up with 2.4%. So that is, of this entire 100%, all of this angst and this demagoguery or not adult-like is that we were talking about 2.4% of greenhouse gas emissions, and you chose to take away property rights because of it.
Thank you, Ms. Mordaunt. Lori Alexiev, followed by Richard Margetson.
Mr. Chairman, our country was founded because citizens were watching their government and spoke up when they didn't like what was going on, didn't like the direction the government was taking it. How is it your members accuse those of us who are trying to protect the founding principles of this country of being ideologues and purveyors of fear? You are all in a position of authority, and when we're called names and denigrated, you are trying to deter us from speaking freely. Intimidation by a government official is tantamount to denying us our First Amendment rights. You are our public servants. It is your obligation to show us respect and to behave courteously. And if somebody isn't doing their job, I think it's time to let them go. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Alexiev. Richard Margetson, followed by Eric Greeney.
Richard Margetson. Thursday at the Water Board on the Los Osos issue, the other thing besides dewatering they're going to be talking about is the recycled water management plan that I've come and spoke about a number of times recently. I submitted 8 pages of comments to the consultant that prepared the document, Wallace Group, to the Water Board, and to the Coastal Commission, also to the Utilities Committee for the Los Osos CSD. As of this moment in time, not one of those bodies have good news, and I have bad news. The county will not do a technical addendum. They will not revise the document. What they are willing to do, though, is when the water conservation plan comes online, on the website, they are willing to start using the new baseline as where we started with the water conservation program. The community paid for this document. To this point, nobody has refuted my comments. Nobody. This is what your staff is doing with these documents. They know it's wrong. They know it needs to be corrected. They know it's obsolete. There are graphs in this document that aren't even relevant, that the bottom line of the graph states that the current situation, or we may get down to 1,700 acre feet of consumption at some point in the future. There's graphs in there that aren't, that are completely obsolete, because we're at 1,600 acre feet now, all verified by the consultant. So when does public comment, and when do you step forward and say enough is enough?
Thank you, Mr. Markinson. Eric Greening, followed by Dr. C. Hyde.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening. Good morning. Before I get to my main topic, a little follow-up on other speakers. I am a member of the Water Resources Advisory Committee, and Lindy Owen is correct that we have not taken up the dewatering plan. I think it would be a good idea if we did. We do have a Los Osos-related item on tomorrow's agenda at the library community room at 1:30 p.m. This is a review of the Water Conservation Implementation Plan, And I think Mr. Margeson just showed a nexus by which the recycled water management plan might be a relevant part of that consideration, even though it isn't actually before us. But anyway, all of these interlinked issues should be considered in an interlinked way. But I want to jump back to another issue raised by other speakers, which is the seismic imaging and the board's position on it to date. Let's imagine that some overreaching environmental agency were demanding that all the fishermen stay in port and out of the water for months. Let's imagine that it was some agency doing it for environmental purposes. I would predict this board would be all over that agency to stop this from happening to the fishermen. And yet, it appears that the board is trusting, when it's PG&E, trusting this rusty old claims act, in this claims process that they have, to somehow mitigate this damage. And the board's concerns, as expressed so far, have been otherwise, primarily the type of boat that would be used to carry this on. And obviously, there would also be economic spillover effects. The people who lease the recreational boats, the restaurants that serve the fresh fish, and on through the community. And of course, then there is the vast environmental damage, which could continue to be economic damage once the fishermen go back in the water. What will they find? We do have other venues where the board can take a stronger reality-facing position. We have to go before Fish and Game, or PG&E has to go before the Fish and Game Commission and the Coastal Commission. We could demand to take this to the fishery, the Pacific Fishery Management Council, to enforce the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery and Conservation Act. There are all sorts. I mean, we could take this to the International Whaling Commission as well as the laws that have been mentioned. But it's time for the board to take a stronger position. It's not too late.
Thank
the
you,
State
Mr.
Lands Commission has Thank done you. Its thing, but there are others. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Greening. Dr. C. Hyatt, and that's my last request to speak on public comment. Dr. Hyatt?
Dr. C. Hyatt, Los Osos World Community Workshop. I believe we invest ourselves in truth or deceit, and wrong, like interest, is compounded daily. I have lived such a unique life. I have witnessed such wrong, experienced the devastating consequences of wrong, that I have attempted to right all wrongs, all inequities. I have lived among a people who were under martial law for 36 years, and our government supported their oppressors. And if they spoke of their own Holocaust, they were dragged out in the night, tortured, and imprisoned. The consequences of the wrong I committed as a young child. We wanted some representation of this board, and now this board is going to have to take responsibility for your choice and your decision, because the people want representation, and the life forms that cannot protect themselves want some representation. They can't defend themselves. As a PG&E ratepayer, I am going to pay for the destruction of all life within the decibel path of the seismic study, and this is a wrong that I just cannot contend with. I had the privilege of being at Avila the day the whales and the dolphins were just off the end of the pier. The wonder went national, went international, and so will this wrong. Do not underestimate the support generated by saving a single whale. And the name of that whale was Humphrey. And it came into a slough. We drove for miles to find it. And the international community put pressure and support, and that whale was saved. Would the people of Fukushima have accepted the destruction of their entire fishery just to know that they live next to a dangerous nuclear power industry? No, they would not. You cannot make a right of this wrong.
Thank you, Dr. Hyatt. And I have received another request to speak. Ms. Seastrand, I'm assuming you don't indicate here that you want to speak during public comment. Is that okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it was just a few weeks ago that I was here to express my opposition to a draft ordinance that would require us to get a permit to exercise our free speech on county property. And here I am again today to express my concerns of my district supervisors, my district supervisor, I reside in Grover Beach, of personal actions and words last week that I think intimidate citizens who come before this board. You are our servants. I know that word is maybe not agreed by all, but we're elected to listen to our constituencies. And I know how hard it is to get citizens to participate, to write a letter, to sign a petition, to come here and express themselves. It's not easy for many citizens. And then when they're more or less called and ridiculed before this body, on TV and so on, and before their peers, I think it's really sad. And so I say enough, and I hope that all of you will give courtesies to the people who try to address their opinions before this board. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Seastrand. Supervisor Gibson, comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to close public comment prior to bringing it back to the board. That was my last request to speak, so I will close public comment on items not on the agenda. Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly in response to the last public commenter, I think the criticisms here are misplaced. This board has an extraordinarily open policy of letting citizens come before it to comment on items both off agenda and with a wide latitude of comments that are made on items on the agenda. And that is certainly a treasured part of this public process. The flip side strikes me that certain commenters get rather sensitive when in the discussion of items, supervisors express their own opinions as to how items should move forward. And I think that with exceedingly rare exception, supervisors on this dais choose their words carefully and express their thoughts clearly, and I expect that those public commenters who would avail themselves of the opportunity to address us would also understand that as supervisors we have opinions too, and we will be making those opinions known as we reason through and make decisions on the important items that come before us.
Thank you, Supervisor Gibson. Supervisor Meech.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to just jump back to a different topic, if I could, regarding the seismic study issue, because mm-hmm. we've had a number of comments. I know we've received a number of emails and letters regarding the concern for this, and I guess I'm becoming more and more concerned relative to the time frame of the migration of whales coming up through our coastline and how that's going to affect them. And I guess, Supervisor Gibson, you've been involved in this quite a bit. Were there other options that were discussed about the possibility of any other type of imaging to find out what exactly they want to find out?
Thank you for raising the question, Mr. Meacham. As to other technologies for gaining the images, there really are none that are going to give us the detailed image of the geologic structures that are fundamental to the understanding of seismic hazard that we need to have at this point. I can assure you that in the many inches of the environmental review of this document, the impacts on marine life were very seriously considered and considered in great depth. In the action of the State Lands Commission, that all life in the vicinity of the seismic survey is going to be ended upon the execution of this survey. That is not the an interpretation of what having a significant impact to marine life is. There are certainly things that we need to be careful about, and the project is conditioned very specifically to take place at a certain time of year, but also with observers on the survey vessels, particularly for marine mammals, so that the survey is shut down should marine mammals come within a specified distance that's thought to be injurious to them. So I think it's a very difficult situation to be in, but the PG&E has been mandated to undertake these by actions at the state level. This board, I want to emphasize in response to Mr. Greening's comment, has very clearly stated the importance of mitigating environmental impacts to the greatest extent possible, compensating the commercial interests that will be affected by these activities properly. And the compensation mechanism is imperfect, but this board is very strongly and very clearly on the record supporting compensation for fishermen and other ocean-dependent industries that might be affected.
Well, one of the other concerns, I guess, is that at what level will these observers, I don't know who the observers will be, I would assume some different other agencies or organizations that might have an opportunity to observe, but if they experience some marine life that is killed off or whatever, at what level do they say stop? Or is there a threshold that...
Well, you know, I'd have to look in more detail. There's an entire plan that PG&E is being mandated to develop, which is marine life protection or mitigation plan, and I don't know the details of that plan. But I can tell you, as regards marine mammals, if a marine mammal, whale, dolphin, otter, is sighted within a specific distance that is determined by the studies of the intensity of the sound, if that animal is spotted, and it will be from observers on the ship and observers in aircraft, then the survey stops right there.
Okay. I guess with the advent of the showing up of all the whales in the last
yes.
couple of weeks, it's and raised a lot more concerns, and almost as if they raised their head up and said, wait a minute, what are you doing?
And you know, the incredible displays that we've seen off of Avila Beach are testament to the richness of the marine life we have here. And again, we're in a difficult situation, but these surveys are not planned for this time of year. And in the dead of winter, it is thought that there will be much less.
And I guess my final question is more, we as a board cannot either stop or let this happen. This is a determination made by somebody else. All we can do is, as we have injected our concerns, and they've been heard from what I understand.
Our concerns were very carefully listened to by the State Lands Commission. Their permit action on the 20th of August was the first in a number of steps of other permits. This item will be before the Coastal Commission in October. Speakers referenced it has to go before the Fish and Game Commission because of the marine protected areas, and then there's a whole set of federal permits that may or may not have public hearings associated with it, but certainly have public input associated with it.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for raising that question, Supervisor Meacham, and for your response, Supervisor Gibson. I do want to again point out that while other agencies and organizations have been participated in this process, and other agencies actually have regulatory authority over the process itself, we will continue to monitor the progress of that. And remember that the purpose of this is to determine the earthquake threat to Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. And I feel that it is, given the fact that new faults have been discovered off the coast that haven't been thoroughly studied, that we do need to get that information to ensure that the plant is operating safely, or any accident there will certainly have a much greater impact on not only the marine environment, but the terrestrial environment also. So we want to proceed as carefully as we can, and this board will stay engaged in monitoring the activity and certainly intervene where necessary and appropriate. And having been involved for the past 30 years in a variety of governmental processes and public hearings, city councils, various other organizations, and the Board of Supervisors, our board, from what I've experienced over the past 30 years, has one of the most generous public participants. Walk us through the process. Again, for the listening public, this is a strategic planning session focusing on the many elements of the Public Works Department here at the county, and we have a series of presentations by Public Works And our department head, Mr. Pava Ogren, will lead us through that presentation this morning.
Chairman Patterson, members of the board, your Public Works Director, Pava Ogren, and I will do some introductory remarks and sort of some brief overviews. And then Dave Flynn, Deputy Director, is up here with me, and then a number of staff members with Public Works will be participating. And we do have a PowerPoint, if I can get that up on the screen at this time, that would be great. The purposes of today's is really to provide a broad brush overview of a number of items that we're working on within Public Works, both items that are going to be coming before your board in the upcoming future for recommended action items, as well as some of our internal business processes. And the approach of taking a very broad-brushed approach, it means that we're going to have about a half a dozen or so relatively short 5 to 10 minute presentations, and then provide, you know, question and answers at the discretion of your board. And we wanted to take a broad-brush approach also, certainly recognizing that whether it's transportation or water resources or some of our interagency efforts, if we don't speak to something specifically, at least in this broad-brushed approach, if there's something on the minds of your board members, then certainly that will help us in the discussions as well. So today's topics, I'm going to introduce just real quickly organization staffing and run through some of the APWA, which is American Public Works Association accreditation that we're working on. Dave is going to lead some discussions as well as with Frank Honeycutt on transportation items on roads and bridges and sidewalks, and Dave's got some interesting statistics on sidewalk issues in Los Angeles if you're interested in understanding some very big numbers out there. Some of the internal business practices associated with capital project delivery we're going to cover, especially in reviewing change orders and what that means. Will Clemens is going to cover special districts rates and charges, including some hearings that are anticipated in this fiscal year and identified in the budget. And then wrapping it up will be Mark Hutchinson and Courtney Howard talking about some interagency efforts and some water resources. On department staffing and APWA accreditation, the APWA accreditation, I'm going to hand out a document that comes out of their practices manual, and it's just sort of to give an illustration of how extensive this effort really is. We have procedural memorandums that certainly date back to the early 1980s and some standard operating practices that on some of our systems that go back. So this is a very intense effort. Overall, for our department, we have about 498 areas, almost 500 areas of specifically looking at how are we operating our internal business practice in comparison to industry standards. There are only three California counties that have been accredited by APWA. The most recent was Orange County. The other two are Contra Costa County and Alameda counties. And certainly we do believe that this is a critical component of our overall strategic planning, is to make sure that we're doing comparison to industry practices in our efforts. And for the public, there's some additional hard copies up near where you hand in the public speaking requests in case anybody's interested. But in any case, the APWA manual itself has got a lot of different items associated with it, including how do we do snow removal. So there are obviously the manual is supposed to be very all-encompassing, national industry practices. We already completed what's called the self-assessment portion of it, which meant that all the divisions within the department went through and looked at the applicable areas for their divisions and said, okay, what are we already doing in these areas? So we've already completed that self-assessment process, and that moves us in the accreditation process, which is then to modify our standard operating procedures, modifying our procedural memorandums to make sure that when we're done with the accreditation process, that we have everything really nailed down in terms of our internal business practices consistent with industry standards. Talking about the staffing then, this quick pie chart just is for general illustration of where is your public work staffing. And starting up at 12 o'clock on the pie chart and moving around, transportation and utilities, obviously the two largest service delivery divisions, in large part because of the extensive operating staff of both of those, as well as development services right around there at about 7 o'clock on the pie chart. And so those three together are what we consider to be our public service group, and they represent about two-thirds of our staffing. Moving then to the next three, from about 7 o'clock to administration, those internal support, we've all had reductions in staffing, both consistent with the hiring processes and hiring chills associated with the current economic climate. But in utilities, the implementation of the Nacimiento Water Project, as well as the upgrade to the Lopez Water Treatment Plant, has increased staffing. And then environmental design and construction have all increased because we are in the midst of the largest capital projects workload in the department's history. So then when I think, and Dave and I talk a lot about where do we see staffing levels go, and we do see the capital project work tailing off in the upcoming years, and so we are very concerned about making sure that as we have retirements and move in the years ahead, that we continue to monitor our workload and capital projects very closely. We do expect decreases in design and construction, especially. Environmental is interesting because, of course, they have a lot of work even after a capital project is completed. And later this morning, Dave is going to speak a little bit to the some of the post-construction requirements associated with capital projects. But in essence, one of the reasons why we've been successful in this economic downturn and not facing any significant layoffs and have been able to work with attrition is because we've been able to move our, especially our engineering resources from the divisions like transportation or development services that have had a decline and move them over into the capital projects work area. And in the coming years, we're going to continue to, you know, look at who's best suited to be able to move into the different divisions so that we can manage our workload efficiently in the coming years. So that's just a real overview of my introductory remarks, both in terms of the APWA accreditation program that we're working through, as well as, you know, the general scenario of where our staffing is at. And if there are questions, be glad to entertain those at this time. If not, then Dave's going to move into some of the topical discussions.
I see none at this point, Mr. Ogren. So if Mr. Flynn wants to proceed with transportation, that would be good.
Hi, good morning. Dave Flynn with Public Works. This will be a short section that reviews kind of MAP 21, the recent federal legislation, and then looks at some of the particulars of our pavement management. And first on MAP 21, that's the federal authorization that just was approved the end of July, and it stands for the Map Ahead for Progress for the 21st Century. It was a long-awaited transportation bill, which does a number of things, but in particular, it consolidates over 100 rather antiquated programs that have developed over 40 years of transportation funding at the federal level into just a few. And with that, there's been some significant changes in terms of how funding will be distributed amongst the state and local entities. You've already been introduced to this in your role as delegates to the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments. You'll most likely continue to discuss that in that role. Today, though, we'd like to just cover some particulars of how it's going to affect us at the county. And one element of MAP 21 is that they have essentially structured how distribution would handle in the program, but then left a lot of the implementation based off of performance measures. And as MAP 21 moves forward, those performance measures will most likely guide the final result. For us, though, there are some particular changes in the funding. One of them is that Safe Routes to School, which was an adopted federal program, will no longer be a specific funding source that we could rely on. It would be bundled in many other potential programming sources. On the whole, highway safety program has been reemphasized at the federal level, and we would see an increase in funding of that. However, the distribution is still remains to be worked out. And then of most concern to the county is the funding for what was the highway bridge replacement program. And there's two categories of bridges from the federal perspective. One is off-system bridges, which is essentially those roads that are pretty much going nowhere, just kind of the dead-end streets, the streets that are not on the major collector roadways. And MAP 21 has assured that there is a set-aside at the 2009 spending level so that counties such as us can still take the advantage of being able to replace bridges on the off-system roadway network. The other system is on-system, which is really the primary bridge routes for the county. And that is something that it's very unclear in the current MAP 21 how those funds will be distributed back to the county. The state, though, has indicated both at their administrative and Caltrans working level, and we have 10 other significant projects that we're moving forward with, and that's estimated to be at least $35 million that we would expect over the next 8 years. And the advantage of this is that in terms of a local match requirement to the county, it's really about $3 million over the next 8 years is what we would need to secure on our end to be able to take advantage of these programs. So this is something that we really need to kind of keep our eye on and see what the future holds. Now, what the future holds is, again, there was a rush somewhat to see if implementation legislation would be done this summer. That did not come to pass. It's expected at this point that in early 2013 there would be state legislation which would implement MAP 21 and would further define how the funds would be distributed, particularly between the state and the local agencies. And what we'll really be seeking would be to get off-the-top funding for the bridge program, to make that whole and keep the status quo going under the new legislation. Also, a program like Safe Routes to School, there is a significant amount of highway safety program funding, which should be essentially set aside for doing a Safe Routes to School under the state umbrella. And most importantly, in terms of the status quo, what we'd be looking for is to retain what is the 62-38 split, and that 62% goes to the state, 38 comes to the local agencies. The current MAP 21 federal legislation would have that ratio at 70% going to the state and 30% going to the locals. So there is some work to be done just to assure that when the state officials say we want to have a status quo, we will expect a return to your board with a letter of support based off of actions from the CSAC and the County Engineers Association to further influence legislation as it moves forward in early 2013. That concludes my MAP 21 comments.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Flynn. What I wanted to ask is you gave us an outline of your 8-year bridge replacement program, and I know in the past you've said once you list a bridge for replacement, it takes up to 5 years to move it through the list and actually get the funding. And you're anticipating ongoing federal funding, assuming that they'll, you know, we're good for 2 years, but we don't know beyond that. And I'm curious if there are things that we should be doing as a board and you as a department to encourage not only our state legislators to continue with state funding, but the federal legislators to ensure that we will get that additional funding, because you have estimated $35 million over the next 8 years is our match to replace what's already on the list, assuming ongoing federal funding. But I'm concerned we do have a lot of off-system bridges here in the county if federal funding doesn't continue at the level that we're hoping it will. If you have any ideas on how we'll be able to address our bridge needs in the county.
Dave Flynn with Public Works. The Highway Trust Fund, which has been funded through federal gas tax for, you know, decades now, has really been where the revenues have come in to fund the highway bridge program over the past. In this legislation, it's still important to measure performance of the infrastructure, both for pavement conditions and then also bridge conditions. And in the annual budget that you adopt, we do measure the bridge performance, which is that we want to keep at least 90% of the bridges in what's called structurally adequate condition. So we monitor that. We expect that that would be reflected upwards through state and federal performance measures. So certainly in your roles as delegates to San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, advocating that level of performance measures will be continued to be needed in order to secure the funding. The funding should be there as they're going to continue collecting federal gas tax. It's just really a matter of how the federal legislation is repackaged in future years after MAP 21 goes through its 2 years. And then as we discussed here, looking then at the state legislation of how those funds are distributed. And that's where we really need to look at trying to establish that program off the top before it's whittled down into smaller and smaller programs in what are the metropolitan.
Making sure that there's a common level of understanding of what the status of infrastructure is and what the funding needs are. And so while Dave was speaking to the importance, especially in the bridge program, of the money being dedicated off the top for bridges, I reiterate that importance because we know that there's a certain amount of money that's always going to be awarded on a competitive grant basis. And there can be a lot of different criteria, but when it comes to the importance of bridges, making sure that they have the dedicated funding so that bridges are repaired when bridges need to be repaired is extremely important. But in the big picture, in terms of our alignment with the Sacramento and our state agencies and CSAC and SEAC, it is one of the continuing policy and legislative priorities that we're working with them on.
Okay, and just to finish up my comments on that, you mentioned the importance of the gas tax to ensure that revenue that's available. Well, it's my understanding that that was not indexed and hasn't changed in the past almost 20 years, I believe. And so we know that we'll have a dedicated source of funding, but it buys less each and every year because it hasn't been indexed. And also at the state level, we are not a self-help county. In other words, we don't have a sales tax that is dedicated towards transportation infrastructure and so forth. And so we're challenged every year to ensure that we do have a funding mechanism and that we don't lose the opportunity to get state and federal funding because we're not a self-help county. Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the matter of bridges, I had always thought that our bridge program was based on the condition numbering of the bridge, a 0 to 100 scale, and the worst ones were the ones we were going to go after. The idea of an on-system versus an off-system bridge, to me, is new, at least, as we started talking about MAP 21, and I wonder if we need to develop a bit of think carefully about a strategy, because the nature of this county being rural and agricultural, a lot of bridges we might replace in the far-flung rural areas are actually fundamentally important to the agricultural economy of this county. And so that's suggestion number one. My question is, do you imagine that there's going to be a different set of rules for on-system versus off-system bridges coming forward? And if so, are we going to get to choose what we think are on- and off-system bridges?
Dave Flynn with Public Works. Yes, there will be two different sets of criteria based off of off-system and on-system. Off-system, what they have dedicated is approximately $75 million annually towards off-system bridges.
In the state?
In the state, correct. That is slightly down over what they had previously had authorized, somewhat speaking to the revenue issue that Supervisor Patterson mentioned. We do not have a means to determine which ones are on systems or off. It's a federal determination. We do have the means to appeal their decisions or try to influence how they select it.
Straight traffic count, is that the criteria?
No, it's a very antiquated system they came up with. For instance, Bitterwater Road is actually a on-system road, and it's an arterial to boot. So it does show you that they did not really go about it in a logical manner. And sometimes it's surprising which ones are off system and which ones are on system. But it is something that will have to be clarified in the legislation in terms of how it's distributed. The bigger battle will be over on-system bridges because in MAP 21, the large component of funding is under a National Highway Performance Program, and those are funds that come directly to the state. It would exclude a lot of our bridges from being on-system based off of their definitions, but under the state implementation legislation, that can be expanded by Caltrans or to Caltrans in terms of developing the program and assuring that there would be sufficient funding to tackle the on-system bridges.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So I see no more questions or comments from the board. I do have a request to speak. Am I thinking, Mr. Greening, I know you have questions that you want to ask. My thinking was that we would get through the staff presentations and then we'll open it to public comment and you'll have an opportunity to ask questions and then staff can respond to that. So, Mr. Flynn.
Yeah, Dave Flynn, Public Works. That concludes the MAP 21 portion. I'd like to turn it over to Frank Honeycutt who will next review the pavement condition.
Good morning. I'm Frank Honeycutt with Public Works. Just to point out, we have Don-spec goal in a 70 as a target goal, and so back in 2007, we changed it to maintain at least an overall PCI of 65. As you can see, we're currently at a 59. Statewide, if you look at the California as a whole, the PCI has dropped down to about 66. Most people still consider 70 as the goal to reach. Statewide, we're not making it, and we're doing even lower here. What this means for us is that if we're going to look at what to do, we need to prioritize our work, look at the benefits of which road we work on versus the cost. And we are recently, in the last few years, we've decided to make better use of chip sealing, and I'll describe that some more in a moment. But what this does is that we have our best roads, which I've labeled here as good roads with a PCI of 65 or greater throughout the county. We need to keep those in a good state, and that would be even a higher priority than fixing a road that has a lower PCI. Also, when it comes time to overlay roads or rehabilitate, we would tend to favor the high-demand roads over low-demand and urban over rural. It's an attempt, so to speak, to get the most bang for our buck. What this does mean, though, is that some roads, particularly the rural, low-volume roads, are going to receive a reduced level of maintenance. And I think the first question that comes up when I say that is that it might sound like they'll get no maintenance, and that would not be the case. It would be our intention that every road in the county would be able to provide all-weather access. However, on these minimally maintained roads, there may be a lot of patching. You may have to drive slower. It won't be a comfortable ride, but you will be able to get home in any kind of weather. As I mentioned, the chip seal, just to throw out some numbers here, chip sealing costs us about $30,000 a mile to perform. Some roads are more, some are less. Whereas on an overlay, you can see in the lower left picture there, is that we did an overlay on Avila Beach Drive a few years ago. That's about 10 times the cost, about $300,000 a mile. So you can see that it again makes sense that we keep our good roads good by chip sealing on a regular basis. A paved road, if we do nothing to it, is good for about 20, 25 years, and then you have to start over with it. Chip sealing can extend that maybe as much as 30 or 40 years, so it's quite the bargain. And at the best long-term management here, again, benefit to cost would be to make excessive use, or intensive use, rather, of chip sealing. I've got some numbers here of what we have done over the last several years and what it has cost. Our work is primarily done by the county road crews. We have been partnering this last couple of years with contractors. May not be readily obvious, but the chip spreader there in the upper right is operated by a contractor, as well as the machine they're placing the oil. What we plan to come back to your board later is with a five-year plan. And this is some numbers of what we plan to do with the five-year plan. Our good roads, we currently have about 485 miles out of our 1,000 that is in decent shape today, good or fair. At the end of 5 years, we would intend to increase that to about 519, which would be about 48% of our total road mileage. Our arterial roads, or those roads with high demands, we have about 23 miles of road that is below the 65. At the end of 5 years, we would expect to have all of those roads overlaid, and then following that, they would become good roads. In this five-year period, we would expect to get some of our collector roads or medium demand roads, and that would amount to about 7%. And finally, just short of 500 miles, or just a little less than half of our overall roads, would be those roads that will receive minimal maintenance. Some of the challenges that we face, I think we've already touched on. Our revenue stream continues to be flat, whether we're talking about gas tax or general fund revenue. It's a challenge to be able to, if we had more funding, we could do more work.
Mr. Honeycutt, that previous table that you had, the five-year projection, that's based on what level of funding?
30 miles per year, that would be a big year for us. So to go to 60 in order to maintain this program is going to be a challenge. We intend to use greater use of contractors, in a sense put it out to bid. Our work, we would have our crews do the prep work, which is extensive, but then rely on contractors for the remaining work. And again, a challenge here is 46% of our roads will be at risk to basically receive minimal maintenance and continue to deteriorate. What we have done, there is some roads that are way out in the hinterland, so to speak, and to go out there repeatedly to patch potholes requires a lot of windshield time. And so when a road does require a lot of windshield time, we will go out there and do what we call a skin patch. It's a very thin overlay. It does improve the road. It's not as good as a real overlay where we put down 2 or 3 inches, but it will do the job. And that's what I have for now, unless you have any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Honeycutt? Yes, Mr. Teixeira.
Thank you very much, Chairman Patterson. Mr. Honeycutt, how do you determine on your PCI what roads or what areas are going to be done, and how intensive are your road estimates? I mean, are you going to go out and do like a section of a half mile, or are you going to go in and do the whole thing, 10 miles? How is that determined?
Well, the way it's determined is that, well, let me back up. Our plan, this five-year plan, would involve about 60 miles per year chip sealing. It would also involve on the order of about 5 miles of overlay. The way we decide which road to do next is, again, we would focus on what we call the good roads. And I suppose you could say the worst of the good roads would go first. We would look at the roads that are just barely 65 to 70, and we would tend to chip seal those first. We also need to consider where our resources are. So the computer tells us there's a road here and a road there and all that, and it doesn't recommend a very logical progression. When we look at the roads, though, we will look at a total area. I suppose if one road is scheduled for next year and it's next to a road that's scheduled from 3 years, we might do them both together just for efficiency's sake. Again, on the overlay roads, though, we will start with the high-demand roads, those roads that have at least 3,500 vehicles per day, and we will do all of those first. And we anticipate to be able to reach every road in the county that fits that criteria within the next 5 years.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Meacham, and I know staff wanted to chime in at some point. You want to wait till...
Go ahead, if you like.
Okay. Mr. Flynn?
Well, to add to Mr. Honeycutt's kind of review there, with the current funding level of about $3.2 million, we would anticipate half of that going to a chip seal list. And as was pointed out, that would be done strictly on those roads that have a 65 PCI or better, just to keep good roads good. That leaves us about $1.5 million to actually pursue an overlay plan. And the overlay plan would essentially be limited then to the arterial roads and some select major collector roads, roads generally that have average daily traffic above 3,000 cars a day. So that becomes a much more narrowed list. And what was shown on the table is that that's what we would be working on over the next 5 years. In terms of selecting those roads, then, we certainly are looking at arterial major collectors with PCIs less than 65 that need to go out and have work done. And generally, we would select perhaps one or two roads at most a year, which would be like an arterial road like perhaps Main Street in Templeton or Taft Street in Napomo, and then just really focus and do that completely. It does not really bode well at that funding level to really look at other outlying roads because they're just not going to meet that criteria.
Okay. Mr. Meacham.
Okay, either for Mr. Flynn or Mr. Honeycutt, either. Would you anticipate, mainly because we're seeing a flattening of revenue and even a decline somewhat in our ability to stay up with things, reverting back from some areas of paving to an all-weather road, as opposed to continuing to try to pave?
I can take that. As we've looked at that fairly extensively over the last 3 years, how we could go in there and, say, revert roads to gravel. But it does seem that those states and other counties that have tried that haven't really seen the cost benefit in doing so. So while a gravel road you would expect would be less to maintain because you have less of an investment, there still is ongoing cost in terms.
Yet we've, in the past few years, set a goal of 65 PCI, and I'm curious if you have an estimate of what it would take as far as an investment's concerned to get our roads back up to a 65 PCI. You showed in the graph that we've trailed off a little bit, and we're down to about a 59 overall now. Do you have sort of an intermediate estimate there?
Well, I could do some figuring in my head. Maybe if I go back to this five-year plan chart.
Mm-hmm.
With this five-year plan and the $3 million, it would look like at the end of 5 years, our overall average PCI would only go up by 1 point.
Right. And that's the $3 million
investment. That's at $3 million a year.
Right.
I wouldn't say that $6 million would get us 2 points, but we're kind of talking that kind of realm. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of roads out there. There's only so much you can do in 1 year, and it's you're affecting a small percentage.
Mm-hmm.
So I can say we can go down a lot quicker than we can go up, unfortunately. So we can run some overall numbers for you that address that better than this, but... It would suffice to say that a little more will improve things a little more, and a lot more will improve things a lot. But
okay. Just curious if there was an intermediate step. The CAO, I knew if I mentioned budget, he'd weigh in. Mr. Grant.
Thank you. Jim Grant, County Administrative Officer. I do want to point out that even though the roads is certainly, you can see that the road conditions are moving on a downward trend, that the general fund contribution overall is $6 million, or close to $6 million a year, and we've been holding that fairly steady over the last couple of years. So it's not $3 million that they're discussing today. That's just in this one portion. It's an overall $6 million general fund contribution, which we believe, with looking at other counties, is still a fairly generous general fund contribution based on all of the budget issues that we've and the board has gone through over the last 4 or 5 years now. So that would be our plan is to, as the things recover, and which would be very slow, that we possibly could recommend a little bit more for the roads, but overall it's probably going to hold pretty steady around that area for another couple of years unless your board wants to make other priority changes. And of course that today it's easy talking about priorities and road priorities because it's important, but when you get the room full of all the other departments, the other 21 departments in here about other needs, it becomes a little less clear in terms of what direction you want to take. So we do the best we can. We're certainly on the administrative side supportive of the roads program, and we try to maintain it as much as possible as we go through our 7-year pain plan. But it is $6 million, and there might maybe a little discussion about where the other $3 million goes. Then if $3 million goes, of general fund goes into pavement management, Pablo, maybe you can speak to the other three, which I imagine is matching funds for bridges and other things.
Certainly, and to reiterate Mr. Grant's comments, we are very much appreciative of the general fund contributions that are available to go into roads, and we agree that we're in a much better position than the vast majority of counties. While there is some matching for some of the bridge and other capital projects that the general fund supports, the distinction here is the amount of money that's going into the contract side of the work, the bids and AC overlays and the chip seal on the contract side, versus the other half of it is really our support of doing that same pavement management program. So as Frank had mentioned, our teams are out there. We do prep work on AC overlays. That's often, like in the community of Santa Margarita over the last couple years, when we did the AC overlay, our crews went in there and they did a lot of the culvert replacements. As part of the chip seal program, they'll work hand in hand with the contract. So the vast majority of the $6 million does help support the overall pavement management program, but a lot of that is our crews performing work in contrast to the contract work.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Oben. I was actually going to speak to that, but first, I think it is important that we don't continue to lose ground here, and that we really need to know the numbers to maintain the current level and then improve it incrementally if we can. And also, I realize there's more to the road itself than just the road. There's a lot of other maintenance right. things that are going on, including signage and just speaking for myself, one of the issues that my constituents, and of course I have a rural district, but what I hear from my constituents most about is roads, and they're concerned about it. And
so far isn't a large problem like roads and sustaining roads, but it's something that we want to make sure that we can head off before it becomes one. I'd just like to note that currently state law states that the adjoining property owners are responsible for the maintenance of sidewalks to keep them in good condition. There was an assembly bill sponsored by Assemblyman Fuentes earlier this year, and it sought to transfer the responsibility of sidewalk maintenance all to local agencies. And your board adopted a letter opposing that back in May to essentially carry on the Streets and Highways Code, which made it the responsibility of the adjoining property owner. Since that time in June, that legislation has essentially evolved into something that pertains almost exclusively to the city of LA in terms of whether or not local agencies can be once adopted an ordinance that states that they are going to maintain it, can transfer it back to the property owners. That has not occurred here in San Luis Obispo County, so the legislation as it stands today is not relevant to our actions with sidewalks. So that was, at least from our perspective, dodging a bullet in terms of responsibilities and expenses for sidewalks. Moving ahead to look at sidewalks, though, this is something that can really come up and become a large issue to deal with. The LA Times earlier this summer had reported that the city of LA had 42% of their sidewalks in disrepair, with a price tag estimated at $1.6 billion and expected to have a 70-year program. That's very long-term thinking for a 70-year program. On top of that, the County Engineers Association and their needs assessment that we mentioned earlier has also been reporting how much expenditures have been done annually by local agencies, and on average, it is running about $33 million in sidewalk maintenance. For us, the last time we really did an evaluation of our sidewalks was about 5 years ago, and we found that there was about 6% of our sidewalks in disrepair, with an estimated cost then of about $3 million. And then our crews do go out and attend to what would be potential tripping and fall hazards, because we haven't really gone out seeking the property owners to make the repairs on a consistent basis. And they've expended about $400,000 over the last 5 years. We expect to come back to your board in late October as part of the APWA accreditation to kind of outline how we would like to attack the sidewalk maintenance issue. Generally, we would see utilizing the sections under the Streets and Highways Code for maintaining the sidewalks. We wouldn't see any separate ordinance action being taken by your board, but that our department would just proceed under state statutes. For what the type of work that we've done largely with our crews has been minor repairs where we've ground off joints that were sticking up high, and that would be work we would continue to do by our crews, just because for that item of work that's say $300 to $500, it's just as effective for our crews to identify it and then address the issue. For larger repairs though, we would expect to put into our procedures means to involve the property owner as defined under the state statutes. This is going to vary from a site-by-site basis based off of what is causing the sidewalk to be in disrepair. Largely, the disrepair is caused by trees. I think that's probably our number one culprit out there. Largely like sycamore trees with perched roots. And those are things that can exist both in little planting strips along the sidewalk or between the curb and the sidewalk, and then also within people's front lawns. And those are the areas that we would want to explore, potentially assessing the property owner for repairs when it is, say, their tree on their property that is creating the cause of the sidewalk. We also know that there's other drainage structures that pass through the sidewalks, draining the properties. Those are also a case-by-case thing that we would look at, as well as several utility vaults and covers that are in the sidewalk. We would expect to go to each individual utility company to get those things addressed. But again, for sidewalks, we would expect to come back late October, outlining what our proposed procedure will be. And then we would like to proceed with this as defined under the state Streets and Highways Code. Is there any questions, or I'd be happy to take questions on sidewalks.
Supervisor Gibson.
Just a comment that I remember a couple of years ago we had this before us.
It's important as well to interface with planning on that, because in some instances they require tree planting as a project condition, and we want to be sure that they're not just creating a problem 30 years from now, that we need to work with them to educate the public on how best to do that. Supervisor Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson. Mike.
Sorry about that. Thank you. My question in regard to sidewalk maintenance in regards to safe routes to schools, with us losing the majority of that funding, it being back put back into the highway department, where are we going to provide this service for the school kids to get them to school safely with sidewalk maintenance and new routes for school, the new safe routes and that kind of stuff?
Dave Flynn with Public Works. In general, the Safe Routes to School program was for capital construction of new routes, and we've taken advantage of that in many communities. it wouldn't necessarily provide for the maintenance of the existing pathways. That's something that we would have to continue to fund either through our maintenance or working with adjoining property owners, depending on the conditions.
So as we continue with the Safe Routes to School program, we're going to have more sidewalk to maintain than we've got now if that program continues as it has in the past, even though funding is very difficult.
Yes, that's correct. There's always the expansion of the inventory of sidewalk, which can really balloon, as in the case of City of Los Angeles. We've seen a significant amount of construction back in the mid-'80s and then in the previous decade, which really expanded our sidewalks. And again, after about 20, 25 years is when we really start seeing the concerns come up over planted street trees and such. And so it's something we have to have a plan to see how we can best manage it.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Flynn, anything else on transportation, streets, et cetera?
No, that would conclude the transportation part. The next section would move on to capital projects.
Okay. I'd like to go ahead and take a break at this point, a short break, and reconvene at, let's say, 11:10. Thank you. Okay, we'll reconvene. And Mr. Flynn, are you going to carry on?
Yes. Our next section is involves capital projects and some of our processings that we're looking at. The two issues that we'll cover briefly today is tracking and monitoring our construction change orders and then our post-construction compliance for our stormwater prevention. For our change orders, just kind of an overview of what's guiding our work. First is the Public Contracts Code, Section 2142, which provides limits and authorizations of what can be provided under change orders and what's authorized by your board to approve. We've also, 2 years ago, Orange County did an extensive study on their CCO tracking, and we are using that as an example to help guide us in terms of our work and our processes. And then the detailed assessment of our CCO business practice really is going to be looking at tracking the causes, resolving issues with the engineer, and then monitoring the budget and authority. And then finally, we would envision following up with a formal CCO policy that's approved by your board for all future projects. In the past, we've done that on select projects, usually the large multi-million dollar projects, but this would be a policy that would be applicable to all our projects. First of a note was the Orange County study done in 2010. What they did was they looked at multiple projects and then developed a database for tracking their CCOs. They reviewed their trends on an annual basis, see what the occurrence and the valuation of those CCOs were. And then they essentially looked at establishing performance benchmarks for themselves and their staff. And then finally, they looked at trends to provide opportunities for to train their staff and then enhance their performance. So this provides us a good roadmap of how we can set out to improve our tracking and monitoring of change orders. We've already initiated a database for looking at the value and number of change orders by project, as well as beginning that issue in terms of looking at what were the causes. And that's where we're headed. So we're tracking our proposed CCOs and approvals on a project-by-project basis. We do enter them into a database then to see what the history is. We are spending a lot more time and look at identifying the causes of the CCO, and particularly going back to typically a consultant to review responsibilities and work effort of how we would be doing this as our internal process. And, you know, with that, too, we would be looking at developing in kind of an all-inclusive CCO policy for all projects. We have done those, again, on the multi-million dollar projects, but this would be just something that's applicable to all projects. And in general, that's always going to apply to any construction change order over the amount of $210,000. Our follow-up actions is, again, we're always seeking to get proper reimbursement through proper processing of change orders, looking at compensation from consultants or engineer of work where we have had some errors in their design plans, and then use this as a springboard for, again, lessons learned, as well as incorporating those type of necessary changes in our development of our contracts and our specifications for future projects. So that concludes the issues on change orders. Be happy to answer any questions on that before we move into post-construction stormwater.
Okay, thank you. Supervisor Meacham.
Just a quick question, and I'm sure that you guys do this in some form or fashion, but as of late, we've had a number of discussions relative to engineering estimates. And how do you review these, or how do you peer review to see how we do a better job of that in terms of some of the disparity that we've seen in the past? Is there a process by which you address that?
In general, we would have our internal quality control processes in our design section that would review stuff that we have developed ourselves. So we do have means of first going back onto our databases of previous contracts to see what the trends have been, and then doing a check within our design division. For outside consultants, it's important that they submit a quality assurance plan that provides some reliance of independent review and check as part of their work. And again, that's an area that we would really need to keep pushing to see what databases they're drawing from, how are they arriving on their checks, and to do kind of our internal compliance on their quality assurance plan.
Thank you.
Mr. Flynn, you mentioned contingency, and when we see contracts come before us, we get the bid for doing the project, and then we add 10% contingency. And in some cases, on those large contracts, that's a lot of money, but it's typically 10% on all contracts, regardless of the size. And I'm just curious if you've gone back to determine exactly how much over time of that contingency we use, and if these change orders typically, you know, bite into that, and how much. And I'm just curious if that 10% number is a real number, and if you've validated that at some point in the recent past.
Yes, when we do projects, all of them are required to do a final report, which itemizes how many change orders and the percent of the budget that was expended beyond the approved contract. That's something that we're then putting back into this database so that we can track what you're suggesting. What was the appropriate amount for the various projects, particularly based off of what was the cost? Was it $250,000, over $1 million? And that's what we're working on currently, is to better refine how we can anticipate what is an appropriate contingency, what's an appropriate performance measure, essentially, for expending the contingency budget that's assigned. And that's something that we would have included in our APWA accreditation memo that we would return to your board again in late October to kind of show you the details of what that would look like.
Chairman Patterson, if I might, one of the reasons why I think that this is an especially important area for the department to pursue, or a couple of the reasons. One is because of a lot of this work already gets done, but it's really relying on the institutional knowledge of the individuals who are working in design or construction. And going through the accreditation program is part of establishing a systematic means of being able to track, so we are less reliant on, you know, the institutional knowledge of individuals, and especially in light of the pending retirement of a lot of the baby boomers. So as we are trying to keep up on, you know, what are the challenges of government and industry in the years that are ahead of us, we, you know, recognize that a lot of this work and a lot of that institutional knowledge will be lost, and so developing, you know, the systems within Public Works helps to improve. In addition, change orders themselves, or potential change orders, because a contractor, if a contractor believes that they're entitled to additional compensation because of a change in circumstances or an error or omission on the design plans or whatever, their initial action is to notify us of a potential change order.
Approval of the new general construction permit. There was extensive monitoring of construction sites. A lot of it is based off of a risk assessment that Regional Water Quality Control Board has developed as part of the permit. Particularly coastal streams require what can be considered a risk level 3 assessment, which involves a lot of testing of turbidity, pH, on an ongoing basis from construction sites. Staff is really trying to include all those elements and hired additional staff to support our efforts in construction so that we can be in compliance over the life of the project during construction. A lot of this stuff has been contested by various agencies, and there has been some lawsuits over the last year, which has eliminated some of the compliance issues, particularly at what's known as a risk 3 level for construction. Nonetheless, it's still our obligation as a county under construction general permits to take care of the site until we have what's called a notice of termination. We, at the end of a construction project, would submit to the Regional Water Quality Control Board our certification saying this project is complete. They have an expectation, in general, this doesn't apply to all projects, but that all the slopes in the disturbed area have at least 70% of plant coverage. That has been quite a challenge to attain in some places, particularly where we've had sandy soils, rocky soils. It's been very, very difficult at times to get a uniform 70% coverage. As a result, without getting that 70% coverage, we are essentially on an endless loop to get to that measure as reviewed and approved by the Regional Water Quality Control Board. That has a trend of just tying up staff indefinitely on projects, reporting endlessly on rain events, and it's just an ongoing obligation and resource demand that we have to adhere to. We have been doing that particularly over this last winter as we try to get jobs signed off. But it's just a kind of a buildup of more and more projects without getting the sign-off approval from Regional Water Quality Control Board. So our staff times and costs are really becoming a noticeable component of our capital projects, because this is what would be kind of the final mitigation aspects of projects. And on the photo on the left here is just kind of generally what we see on projects when we're done, is some growth but not a lot of growth. On the right would be more the level of growth that they would want to see Regional Water Quality Control before they sign off projects. And this project in particular was done on the coast, which has pretty good rainfall, pretty good soil conditions, and so it was not unattainable to cover 70% of this site. But again, on our sandy areas down in the South County region, some of our rocky areas, and soils in the North County, it's becoming very, very difficult to attain the level of criteria that they're expecting. This just results in ongoing monitoring for periods well beyond when we considered the project completed. This is an issue that, again, Regional Water Quality Control Board is having some hearings, I believe, on their Thursday 6th, the 6th meeting. This is also on the agenda or is to be discussed. I'd be happy to answer any questions regarding this or concerns you may have.
Well, I appreciate an ongoing report on how you're doing with this. It sounds like it has become a challenge to the department to meet this criteria, but I do think it's important that we do, and I'm just curious to know, as we go forward, what you're doing to accomplish that criteria. Supervisor Teixeira, and then Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson. Dave, is there a criterion as per the steepness of the slope? So as it gets steeper, is there less requirement for coverage or more requirement? Because I know on some of these where they make the big cuts in the fills and stuff, you got a pretty severe slope, and it's tougher to get stuff to grow, like you said, in South County, than it is on something not quite as steep.
Not that I'm aware of that they have essentially a sliding scale based off of the slope. If anything, what I've seen is, like Caltrans has a landscape architectural group, which has really been promoting trying to develop flatter slopes in all the road designs in order to attain the proper growth. And unfortunately, that might be a direction that we're going to have to do, which would essentially increase the footprint of projects in order to get flatter slopes to promote the growth that's expected.
Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question really goes to that business of how we coordinate with Caltrans, and I was looking at the photos you put up. That looks like the Highway 1, right?
And the potential to have separate type of contracting on large projects to get the planned establishment done.
Are you dialoguing, Mr. Flynn, with the regional board on these issues? And you said there was a backlog of the meeting the criteria and getting them to sign off on it.
Yes, we are. We've sent some correspondence even last fall to address this issue. We haven't really gotten any uniform response from them, but we are doing it on a case-by-case basis to get approval of the notice of terminations. Mm.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Carry on.
So our next section is going to be Will Clemens, and he's going to has a couple of slides on overviewing some of the special district finance-related items. And then a brief preview on four that we'll be coming back to your board on this fiscal year.
Mr. Clemens.
Chairman Patterson, members of the board, I'm Will Clemens with your Public Works Department Finance Division. So just briefly going to touch on our special districts. And when we talk about special districts, we're talking about the flood control district and its many various zones. We're talking about the Napomo Lighting District. We're talking about all our county service areas. Those are all considered special districts. We might have about 15 in total, but we probably have upwards of almost 50 different funds. So each special district might have several different funds that we monitor. And so each year during the budget process, we take a look at obviously revenues and expenditures, and what I'll be doing today is kind of pointing out some that we know we're going to need to move forward on rate increase process through Proposition 218 and the public outreach that requires. So just overall, this kind of gives you a scope of the different types of activities our special districts fund. There's water, sewer, flood control, road maintenance, lighting, and really, as you can see, the majority of our work is water-related, about $20 million a year in O&M and another, what is that, $15 million or so in debt service that we oversee. And so I'm going to kind of focus in on those water-related operation and maintenance and debt because the big portion of that is our wholesale operations. So this is our water-related O&M. You can see the big chunks of the pie involve flood control zone 3, which is the Lopez water distribution, Nacimiento water operations, state water operations. So those are our big wholesale services. And then the smaller retail water is our county service areas in various communities around the county. So you can see, you know, about three-quarters or more, probably more around 80% is wholesale versus retail. This shows water-related debt service. The biggest chunk of the pie is obviously Nacimiento and funding for that project. But state water has significant debt service that we pay both to DWR and CCWA for those facilities. We did just upgrade the water treatment plant at Lopez, flood control zone 3, and completed the dam retrofit. So we have significant debt service to fund those projects and to a lesser degree our retail areas, our county service areas have smaller debt that we're paying back. So some of the ones that we're going to address as far in the upcoming year. I just wanted to focus on four of them. Flood control zone 4, which is maintains the partially maintains the Santa Maria River levees in a contractual relationship with the County of Santa Barbara. flood control zone 16, which is various drainage basins, mostly throughout Napomo. We do have a few in the North County that are funded through flood control zone 16. There's County Service Area 7A, which is our wastewater plant at Oak Shores, Lake Nacimiento, and County Service Area number 16, Shandon Water Service, that we'll need to address. So this chart shows flood control zone 4, the levee maintenance down there on the Santa Maria River. And the challenge with this particular fund is we're contractually obligated to pay a percentage of the maintenance for those levees to the County of Santa Barbara. All the soft costs and the staffing costs had to be paid through the County of Santa Barbara's fund, which we then are obligated to pay a share of. Now, they did go through a flood assessment increase process, Prop 218, and it was voted down. So I guess the good news, you might say, is that we don't see the ongoing expenditures increasing any time in the near future, but still they're above what we can fund now. And so what we've done over the past several years, the green area, is we've transferred in some funds from the flood control district to make up the difference. So we're going to have to put it out to the property owners whether they want to increase that flood assessment. It'll be a significant percentage increase, but as far as a dollar increase, I don't think it will be that significant. So we'll have that process to look forward to in flood control zone 4. And I'll move on unless there's any questions on zone 4.
I see none, Mr. Clemens, at this point.
Flood control zone 16, you can see our reserves, which is the black triangles, are look to be fairly sufficient. But the challenge in this zone is that prior to Prop 218, we had a set amount of a flood assessment for all the parcels that paid into this fund. And then once Prop 218 hit, as we added drainage basins, what we did is we had a specific vote for those parcels to provide funding for that specific basin. But the general basins that have been there for decades still have that basic amount of revenue, which you can see in the yellow. And the blue area is the basin-specific revenue. So those revenues really can only be used on those specific basins that they're assessed for versus the general basins covering all the rest of them. And what we found is that general amount needs to be increased to cover all those older basins from decades ago that were constructed. And again, we've started to fund just a hair of our operations from a transfer from the flood control district parent, which will need to increase our rates to cover that amount. So that's flood control zone 16. The next one it will be addressing is County Service Area 7, wastewater at Oak Shores. And as you can see from the graph, our revenues are made up of sewer service charges in the yellow, property taxes in the blue, and a transfer in of property taxes from the parent fund of CSA 7. So our revenues have been just covering our expenditures recently. However, what this is showing is that there's the property taxes have been supplementing the user fees for the wastewater system. So typically you want your sewer service fees to cover the sewer service, and then that frees up the property taxes for other uses. Could be used for capital purposes, et cetera. So I see this as a multi-year process where we would increase the user fees to try to get us up to the point where it covers our O&M, and then that will free up those property taxes to pay for our capital needs in that system, which are significant and which the Utilities Division will be addressing this year as far as planning for. Any questions before I move on? Mm-hmm. Finally, CSA 16, Shandon. You can see here our water charges are, at least in the recent past, insufficient to cover our O&M expenditures. That wasn't the case maybe 5 years ago, but with the economy, we've seen in Shandon a great reduction in our revenues. So we knew we were going to have to do a rate increase to get back to covering our O&M expenditures. But what we're also doing in Shandon is we're building a state water connection. And so there in 11-12, the green revenue is showing a transfer in from the parent from reserves, and that was to be used to fund that connection to state water. Now, we are pursuing grant funding and perhaps a loan to make that connection, and if we get that, it will greatly help our reserve balances, but we're still left with the structural deficit, different interests. So we'll probably see these coming forward, not all together, but spaced out depending on how quickly we can have the public outreach, the meetings in the various areas. And, you know, it'd probably be nice for you all to have them all on one meeting and we can get them over with.
Well, that certainly is sort of a little bit of feedback from your board, because historically we have taken the special district rate increases sort of on a case-by-case basis. But Will has been talking with me lately about the efficiencies of the process and whether or not we would want to structure them to try to come all together at the same time. There's some benefits associated with that, because then individuals in one district, you know, will get some insight as to this is happening in other districts as well, so it's not a just us type of a situation. You know, in the fall, of course, every year your board considers the countywide fee schedule, and so we wouldn't want to combine it with that, but the idea is that when you're looking at your overall fees, you're doing that as one part of the process, and certainly if it's your board's pleasure that we, you know, either which way you really want us to go, whether you want us to continue to bring them case by case, or if you think there would be value in bringing them and trying to time them all together. You know, Will's indicating there's pros and cons to both, but again, mm-hmm. if there's a preferred board direction, we'd certainly follow that.
Okay, we might address that issue. I know you have two in the south, or one in the south county, two in the north county, and then one that is countywide, so that may be an issue. But, you know, in order for these to be successful, you need a very extensive outreach piece to that, and I don't know, I'd be looking from to Public Works to see if you have the resources to go out to each of these areas and do the public outreach that's necessary. And even then, you're not guaranteed success, as we've right. found out. Supervisor Gibson?
Well, that was one of my points, and I'd be interested in a brief comment as to how much public outreach on these different ones. We did see in Cayucas, which was a successful rate increase for a specific piece of infrastructure that the community fully understood. And I'm just in general terms, how much lead time has there been on each of these four? And my other question is, I did see it in both the third and the fourth graphs there that appeared to me that reserves of that particular CSA had gone negative, and I was curious as to what that meant and how that was going to be resolved.
So what we were looking at in those graphs, those are projections. So we do usually budget very conservatively, and actually, we are projecting to go negative if everything stays status quo. But we definitely, so this one, for example, is CSA 16. We do need to address the rate increase sooner if we don't get the grants for the project. Now, if we get the grants, then this graph is not accurate, because we wouldn't be using our reserves to fund the project. So we're not that bad yet.
Okay. Good.
But that is a projection. And
Similarly, on the other ones, those like Oak Shores, we budget fairly conservatively, which shows us going negative in reserves probably sooner than we really would.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I see no further comments from board members here at this time. So we'll move on to water resources.
Yeah, in order to wrap.
And our final item for the morning is legislation.
Yeah, so this is the last one, and I think, Courtney, you might as well jump up there with Mark. I sort of interrelated the Mark's environmental work on interagency relations with Courtney Howard's on water resources, and they certainly overlap a lot. I also noticed that Laura Edwards, who is the executive director of the Los Tablas Upper Salinas Resource Conservation District, has attended today's meeting, who and Laura and the RCD have been helping us with one of the programs that Mark is going to summarize today.
Very good, and we will be hearing from Laura as we move into public comments. So, Mark, I guess you'll be leading the charge here on water resources.
Thank you and good morning. I am Mark Hutchinson, the Environmental Division Manager for the Department of Public Works, and I have with me Courtney Howard, our Senior Water Resources Engineer. I want to talk just briefly about the topic of building interagency relationships. First, how it relates in the environmental regulatory field and then also in water resources. This flowchart in front of you is our basic environmental regulatory process. Most projects that we do in public works follow this flowchart or one very similar to it. I just wanted to point out that in the blue boxes is a listing of various agents now, and found that most projects have fewer than 25 agencies involved other than us. The average number is in the 12 to 14 range. So we do interact with quite a number of other agencies. They're either giving us funding or giving us a permit or commenting significantly on the project. So early on, as we developed an environmental division in public works some 10 years ago, we came up with a way of operating in a mission statement and also various vision statements. And this is one that we have implemented over the last decade to guide how we relate with other agencies. And it is simply a teamwork ethic. We work with other stakeholders, that is, other agencies and members of the public, to achieve first regulatory compliance, environmental stewardship, and then, importantly, on-time project completion. We do that on a staff-to-staff basis through some significant training efforts. And the key is actually understanding the other agency's regulatory approach to things. We need to know what legislation, what statutes, what regulation the other agency is applying so that we can respond appropriately with the information they need to give our project a permit. We also need to know how that agency is organized, who's who, what are the branch offices, who reports to whom. And then probably most importantly, I put the bullet there of regulatory history. How does the agency go about implementing their programs and policies? And also, what is the litigation history of that agency? Where have they been in court, either on a statewide or national basis, and how have they responded to those decisions, and how does it affect how we speak with them? Essentially, we need to get inside their head, understand what they're about, learn to speak their language, and then structure our project to support what it is they've been instructed to do through state or federal legislation. Not an easy task sometimes, but that is the approach that we take, and we've found in most cases it is at least moderately successful. We've seen other agencies that take a different approach, one that's much more adversarial, and although there are occasions when we've had to go that route, we believe that a teamwork approach is much more efficient and much more beneficial to the project and certainly to the public overall as we attempt to accommodate and implement all of these other regulatory approaches that get involved with the Public Works Department. But in addition to regulatory agencies, we also work alongside and in partnership with other local agencies and organizations. I just want to highlight three examples here. One is we're working with the Los Tablas and Upper Salinas Resource Conservation District. That agency has significant expertise in areas involving flood control and urban stream maintenance.
We commonly intersect with them in streets and roads, our flood control district, specifically in urban areas. So we have a current process, a project with Las Tablas RCD to develop an urban stream maintenance program. Manuals, perhaps even blanket permits that landowners in urban areas could use to guide their management of the stream that's on their property in order to avoid some of the issues that we see with flooding and debris and channel blockage and those sorts of things. At the same time, we're working with the San Luis Coastal Resource Conservation District on a fish passage program for public roads. Various agencies and groups have gone out and evaluated fish passage issues throughout the county, and as you can imagine, some of the blockages to fish passages are in fact road crossings. The basic work is there, and we're working with San Luis Coastal to take the next step and develop a much more detailed database of where these streams intersect with county roads and the degree of fish passage issue that's involved, so that when we get involved in maintenance or capital projects with road crossings, we can speak from a very strong database of information with the regulatory agencies and be much more efficient with the use of our funds. This stems from a regional general condition adopted by the Army Corps of Engineers that was given to them by the National Marine Fisheries Service that simply says anytime you're working on a road crossing that may have steelhead at any point in the future, it needs to be a bridge. That's a great thing for fish, but when you look at a capital project's cost, we could easily be raising the cost of a culvert replacement project by a magnitude of 10 or 20. So we felt it was important to put the money that has the best bang for the buck for fish and roads, and we're going to do that by working with the RCD to enhance our fish passage program. And then lastly, an example of where partnerships can be of great benefit. We worked with Cambria Green Space, who also engaged the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County and several other state and local agencies on a project called Ferrasky Bridge. This is what the Coast Unified School District and the Fiscalini family were able to install this structure. This was definitely an off-system crossing. There was no traditional bridge replacement money available for it, but the major funding, as it turned out, came from the Wildlife Conservation Board in excess of $1 million. This is just one example of where our partnering efforts are directed in order to leverage appropriate funding and interest to the benefit of the community.
Mr. Hutchinson, what was the total cost of that project?
I'll look at Dave Flynn for that.
That was about $1.2 million for the county. Land Conservancy, though, did a lot of pre-development activity, and they had spent about $300,000 in plan development.
And if I could point out that the barrier that was there in the original crossing was considered the most significant barrier to steelhead in this district of fish and game. And so there was a lot of interest from a variety of agencies in seeing this particular project go forward. A great success for all concerned.
Great. Ms. Howard, you're taking over now, huh?
Yes, and right. We will continue to utilize and improve upon our interagency relationships as we develop the updated integrated regional water management plan. Again, Courtney Howard from County Public Works Water Resources. Whereas with the Master Water Report that was recently finished up, we focused on quantity of water supplies and projects. We're going to start to focus more in on the water quality ecosystem flood control components of the IRWM plan with this update. And to help with that update, we submitted a grant application for $1 million to update our plan, and we're recently notified that we are recommended for funding, so that would be $1 million, and we anticipate that recommendation being final in October. So the components of that planning grant are shown in this chart here. Some of the allocation went to the overall plan update to meet current standards, but we also included some focused planning efforts related to water quality and watershed management. The first component is salt and nutrient management and recycled water planning. Really, the impetus for this is the regional or the state water board's recycled water policy, which requires all water and wastewater entities to come together to fund these salt and nutrient management plans. And it has to do with taking a more basin watershed approach towards salt and nutrient loading. And so we utilized this grant opportunity to help further some of the salt and nutrient management planning and recycled water planning efforts that are going on throughout the county. The two higher priority basins where these efforts are starting to take place are the Santa Maria Groundwater Basin and the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin. And so there's components for furthering the understanding of the Santa Maria Basin in support of a salt and nutrient management plan, and also doing a salt and nutrient management plan for the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin. Part of that is the basin model update. $50,000 was allocated to that because some of the effort in that model update benefits both the salt and nutrient management plan and the model update. And then we have more of a regional approach for salt and nutrient management plans. You know, where are the other basins where these plans are going to be needed? Who are the stakeholders involved with that? What are the priorities for implementing them? So that's the $15,000 allocation to look at the whole county in terms of salt and nutrient management planning. The last component of the salt and nutrient management planning component of the grant is identifying and prioritizing recycled water strategies. So that is compiling information on what it takes to implement a recycled water project. What are the regulatory requirements, the permitting requirements, the financing mechanisms that may be required, and then also looking at particular wastewater facilities throughout the county that are considering upgrading to recycled water programs. So that's a quick summary of the salt and nutrient management planning component of the grant. The other big component of the grant is watershed management planning. And so, again, here we're partnering with the RCDs, both RCDs, to comprehensively look at the county, what different water management, watershed management planning that has occurred, and how do we prioritize implementation of different programs and needs that have been identified. I kind of covered most of this, but I just wanted to focus on the agencies that will be partnering with each of the components. So for understanding where we need salt and nutrient management plans, we're not only going to work with the RAC and various agencies throughout the county, but also consulting with the Regional Water Board on their priorities and where they what they see as adequate for salt and nutrient management planning throughout the county. The Paso Robles Groundwater Basin Salt and Nutrient Management Plan covers the watershed surrounding the groundwater basin, and so the agencies then provide feedback as that project's being developed, and that project would be led by a flood control district. And there's also I wanted to mention there'd be one or more public meetings for each of these components in the scope of work. And then the Regional Recycled Water Strategic Plan, again, consisting of a steering committee of agencies that would provide input as the project goes along and is led by the flood control district. Templeton, Morro Bay, Pismo Beach, South County, San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District, Rio Grande, Grover Beach, Oceana, and Napomo. In essence, because while the first parts of this strategic plan are general in terms of what it takes to implement a recycled water plan, there's also a component for each of those wastewater facilities in those areas to look at how, in detail, how they might implement a recycled water plan. For example, who might be recipients of that recycled water, or do we do a recharge project with that water? So those types of details will be vetted in that scope of work. And then for watershed management planning, both RCDs, Upper Salinas Las Tablas and San Luis Coastal RCD, looking at where we have watershed plans and where we don't have watershed plans, kind of a gap analysis. And then also the Central Coast Salmon Enhancement and Land Conservancy are involved with another portion of that effort is to look at how to conduct in-stream flow studies to better understand water needs for the ecosystems and specific species in each of those areas. So trying to further the methodology to be done if we wanted to learn that about certain streams. That ends mine. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from my colleagues? Seeing none. Thank you for your efforts in water planning on behalf of the county. I know you've been very busy, especially in the North County with the Paso Basin. I'm glad to see progress being made there. And Mr. Hutchinson, I just wanted to comment on your guiding principles and or key principles, and that is the teamwork, and then also your efforts working with the regulatory agency to really understand what their emphasis is on so we can make progress there. I think it's a better strategy to go that route than trying to confront them and challenge them every step of the way, as some do. And so I appreciate that. Supervisor Gibson's comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I would add on to that. We're seeing the benefits of that cooperative approach played out in our large infrastructure projects. I'm not as familiar with Nacimiento Water as I am with Los Osos Wastewater, but there's been a number of very good contacts made that have moved that project forward. I would note that there's a lot to do yet, to me, in interagency coordination and cooperation. You know, Mr. Hutchinson talked about the regulatory agencies, and Ms. Howard talked about a number of agencies, special districts, other jurisdictions like cities that she's involved with in the planning. But I think planning is quickly leads to the need for delivery of infrastructure, and I think there's the frontier, if you will. We're seeing a lot of particularly our water supply issues being regional in scale. I think the county has a very important role to play, and I think we need to honor the approach that Public Works has taken to date and enhance it as we move forward to get cooperative agreements in place on the delivery of infrastructure. That said, a lot of the jurisdictions and special districts and other agencies we deal with are local in nature, like CSDs. And I think the what they can particularly bring to the table here is the connection with their constituency, because in the end, getting these infrastructure problems or infrastructure projects delivered depends on understanding the need, and I think the public understanding the need for these things to happen. So I look forward to continued discussions, continued public conversation that makes it clear to the public that it's in their best interest to have these things undertaken. Infrastructure is not the sexiest topic that we deal with, but as we see both from a quality of life standpoint and an environmental protection standpoint, increasingly important. So
right,
look
and
forward to that conversation.
Oftentimes it's the lack of infrastructure and resources that drive the decisions we make, and I'm happy to see that we're pursuing that up front and taking that on. I want to pause here with staff's presentation. The last thing I have on my list is legislation, but we have some people in the audience that want to speak specifically to some of the items that have already been addressed, so I wanted to bring them forward and let them comment, and then as we wrap things up with legislation, perhaps.
And is 4 years too stretched out in terms of the demand for retrofitted fixtures? So those are just a couple of staffing questions. Then backing up to the roads, fund-wise, there, in addition to the $3 million and the $3 million adding up to the $6 million of general fund contributions, there are also then the road fee areas that are also pouring money into the roads budget, and many of those are actually capacity projects, not just maintenance. So how does that fit into the financial picture? All of these are non-gas tax or non-driver related sources, except for the gas tax that that feeds into some of this. But then my environmental question with this is, collectively, all of the road work and capital improvement work being done by the county, what is the collective source of aggregates, base, quarried materials that's used on an annual basis from the county? Do we track how much that is, where it comes from, and at what level is that looked at for in terms of environmental review? Usually it falls to the quarry projects themselves rather than to the end user. But I'm just wondering, now that the county is looking at its greenhouse gas emissions, and that a lot of emissions are involved with both the quarrying operations themselves and the transportation of materials. Are we taking a comprehensive view of that so that we as a county can start looking for what projects are truly needed, what is their ecological footprint, how might we mitigate that, either with alternative ways of getting there or whatever? So those are just a few questions I have time to ask in the 3 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Laura Edwards, followed by Richard Margetson. Good afternoon, Laura.
Good afternoon, supervisors, Madam Clerk, staff. Pavo thought it would be a good idea for me to come and give a little bit more information about the creek stewardship program that we have embarked upon with the county. And in support of that, I brought each of you a draft copy of a creek stewardship guide that we are developing for all of San Luis Obispo County. So I'll circulate these.
Good. And when you get back to the podium, if you'll tell us who you're representing this.
Absolutely. Laura Edwards, Executive Director of the Upper Salinas Las Tablas Resource Conservation District. One of my goals will be to simplify that name someday. So there is a recurring theme today that I heard throughout each of the presentations, which was teaching landowners how to be good stewards of their own back and front yards and the resources therein. And so that is in large part what our program is about with creek stewardship. Since most of the creeks in San Luis Obispo County do flow on private lands, it's really important for us to empower those citizens to know how they can get in those streams, what permits are needed, and how we can empower them to do the necessary stewardship to keep them healthy. And some people don't even know if it is a creek or if it's a storm drain. So having a resource like the Conservation District is great because we do so much with private landowners so that we can get down in the creek with them. We can walk through it. We can tell them what is needed. We also have what's called a Partners in Restoration Permit Coordination Program, which enables us to issue permit for 18 specific restoration projects that have to do mostly with creek stewardship and erosion control. So we're able to give them a one-stop shop and simplify some of the permitting hurdles that often send them in the opposite direction of conservation and restoration and make that more simplified. Mm-hmm. And so that is just a brief summary. And go ahead and look through this manual. Know that it is a draft guide and that we are in the process of finishing up the graphics and cleaning up that guide before we circulate it to some of our partner agencies for further comments and add the necessary logos. Are there any questions?
Yes, Ms. Edwards, I'm curious. I know the Upper Salinas Las Tablas RCD is North Coast and Northern San Luis Obispo County inland, and the creeks you identify and rivers in this document are ones that are included in that region. Are you working with Coastal San Luis RCD also, and will they be a part of this effort so it will actually be countywide?
Very good question. They are one of the agencies that we will be circulating.
After that, right there. Right there.
Okay.
Thank you. Richard Margetson. First of all, I want to follow up Eric Greening's comment that I am curious as to the five people that the implementation plan for the conservation program for Los Osos, where they're going to be in the budget for those 4 years. But the reason I wanted this slide put back up talking about engineer of work, consultant responsibility, the third line down. If you're talking about change orders for the Los Osos wastewater project, what's the triggering, who has the authority over determining the triggering mechanism for that process to start? And I guess the reason I'm bringing this up is if we get to the point that the collection system is built and the laterals are all to the property lines and people start connecting and, you know, they start having problems, or there starts a problem develops with the system, or, you know, whatever. Once it goes online, if there's a problem detected, would it be on the contractor, or would it go back to the engineer who designed the system if there's a problem, you know, 6 months after the collection system's finished, but prior to, but shortly after the collection system goes online at the treatment plant, how that process would work. I'm also concerned about that line as to consultant responsibility and what triggers the county for asking for revisions of documents or things associated with construction projects. And specifically, the one example I brought up recently is this recycled water management plan is, as of its printing, was obsolete. It's been proven it was obsolete. At what time and what triggers us, the county, going back to the consultant and asking for a refund, a revision at their own cost, or something? Or is it just stamp it to get it off the checklist, send it to the Coast Commission, get it off their checklist, and move on? My other question is, there was very little discussion about the Los Osos Wastewater Project, and I want to focus my last 20 seconds on the two pie charts that were put up there by Will Clemens. There's nothing on either of those talking about any of the revenues that you're currently collecting as a percentage of total revenues collected for infrastructure projects in the county now, because you are collecting revenue on the tax rolls to be paid to these agencies in the future when the project's built.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Seeheit.
Dr. Seeheit, Los Osos Rural Community Workshop. And those were very good pictures of the broken sidewalk, and that's what I'm addressing today, sidewalk maintenance. And I'm going to inform you for the third time, Arroyo Grande, you have a liability, you have a trip and fall risk on your sidewalk, and that sidewalk is between the section where the AMPM market is, where the bus 10 comes through to pick up passengers. There's a length of sidewalk, and then there is a freeway overpass and another length of sidewalk to the village. And this liability occurred when some members of this board wearing different hats decided that people could travel many more blocks from Arroyo Grande Village up to the AMPM to get the 10 that used to come into the village, and also decided that you could ignore petitions that tried to stop that schedule change. So I really appreciate when walking through Arroyo Grande that many, many sidewalks have been leveled out, and it created a false sense of security to me. I've gone back and filmed it. There was a false sense of security that I found all of these wonderful places up with the financing for a mobility scooter, because I'm absolutely not walking over that sidewalk where I broke my arm. So this is your third warning. You have a liability there. And your idea of letting the property owners take care of the cracks in the sidewalk isn't working. Thanks again for sanding off all of the other cracks in the village, but it gives a false sense of security when you have huge cracks along a route that you have to walk to get to a bus. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hyatt. And that concludes our request for public comments. So I'll bring it back and have staff wrap up their presentation with legislation and any responses to the questions raised in public comment, that you have that information readily available that you want to share this afternoon, that would be great. And if not, then we can follow up with that at a later time.
Certainly. I think I'm going to wrap it up here on behalf of the department. In response to the public comments, certainly the staffing associated with the Water Conservation Implementation Program for Los Osos is going to be funded by the Los Osos Wastewater Project. Those all result from conditions that were established on the project. The staffing level itself will vary. We anticipate that we will be in front of your board September, October with the implementation plan, and then would plan on moving forward with implementation shortly thereafter. And we have staffed up the project staffing overall. But again, the question was sort of focused on who's going to be, where are those funds going to come? And they are, it is from the project itself. On the road impact fee areas, somebody had mentioned that we do have fee errors. They were accurate, that it's focused on capital project capacity, circulation plan updates. In contrast to the earlier discussion where we're not a self-help county, and in order to get certain state revenues, you have to be a self-help county, well, our road improvement fee program has also helped in getting other funding where we had to have that program in place. So it's a, you know, obviously it can't fund all of the work that's required, but it has been an important component of our work effort, and it does make us grant eligible in some situations. You know, I think with respect to Dr. Hyatt, the idea that, yes, Arroyo Grande has some of the challenges that we at the County of San Luis Obispo have and that the City of Los Angeles has. Just to clarify again, the county, though, didn't decide that the people who own the property are responsible. As Dave had mentioned, that is part of existing state statutes. And sometimes I look at state statutes and I think that Sacramento reflected how difficult these types of issues can be, and so they've decided it in Sacramento. But in any case, the other issue, which I think is a really good one, is the engineer of work and the consultant. What's the authority to trigger the process? And essentially, to me, that question is, when we do have to initiate action against a design engineer, or if it's the contractor, or even it's potentially the construction manager, that most often these issues are dealt with by your board at looking at the facts and circumstances in closed session, and trying to see, is there a responsible party? So it's not, when we get into the claims process or into professional liabilities issues, it's staff working closely with county council especially and looking at those facts and circumstances. And, you know, we kind of talked today in the context of, you know, these being public work strategies, but the reality is that a number of them were either working closely with the administrative office or working closely with county council in order to develop strategies on responsibilities that are primarily public works. But how would that actually, you know, in any situation, Mr. Margeson sort of threw out a hypothetical, is it going to be the contractor or is it going to be the engineer of work? Who's going to be responsible? And again, it's going to depend on the facts and circumstances of that particular case. I will say that with respect to, you know, at the Nacimiento, we had the intake collapse, and the design engineer, Black and Veatch, was very cooperative in addressing that issue, and I think that's going to be on your board's open session next Tuesday for a proposed settlement agreement. But in any case, our part of our strategies here on construction change orders are, again, to develop a system that works well for public works, it works well for county council, and it makes sure that we can get to your board as timely as possible when issues do develop so that they can get resolved as timely as possible. Transitioning really quickly then in just the final slide on the legislative update, and we already covered MAP 21 sidewalks and some of our stormwater MPDES efforts, so I'm just going to quickly speak to quagga mussels themselves. And the good news there is that the legislation did pass. What generally we were seeking, us and other counties, and as supported by your board, was about a $10 get somebody from the Central Coast onto the technical advisory committee to the director of boating and waterways in order to help in the shaping of the program. ex-Monterey representative. Laird is, of course, the secretary of the Natural Resources Committee, so if our Natural Resources Agency. So if it's not within San Luis Obispo County, at least hopefully it's from Monterey County in order to be able to represent the Central Coast in the development of the program itself. And, of course, we also expect that Lake Tahoe will be going after a lot of the money that's going to be available for local agencies. The other two, the National Flood Insurance Program for agricultural facilities that your board supported, did get extended at the federal legislation, so that was good news. A challenge at the federal level is that under the agricultural bill, the removal of the housing exemption, which is part of the USDA funding for on-lot costs if disadvantaged individuals have to have roof repairs or other things done, USDA was an option for them, and that exemption, that housing exemption, might be lost. So we anticipate we're going to be coming back to your board seeking support in order to maintain the housing exemption, and that's especially important also for Los Osos and disadvantaged individuals being able to access USDA money for their on-lot lateral costs. And then lastly, the bill that sort of didn't go anywhere, we were seeking legislation protection for co-location of landfills with composting, recycling, diversion facilities. And that's sort of similar to the Right to Farm Act, that if new development comes in and there's a pre-existing use, that it would be protected. But that did not go very far in Sacramento. And so that concludes our responses to public comments as well as a brief legislative update.
Thank you, Mr. Ogren and Mr. Splann and the rest of the Public Works staff participating today. It was quite informative. Any comments or questions from my colleagues before we wrap it up? Seeing none, again, thank you. And I'll ask County Council if we have a closed session item today.
No, we don't.
No closed session. With that, this meeting's adjourned. Thank you.